Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week we have another jam-packed show for you. Our first guest is Mike Whitney, and we have two other guests after Mike. So stay tuned, and we will be talking to some people who have an organization called Wrong Kind of Green. But right now, I will be interviewing Mike Whitney again. Mike lives in Washington State. He's a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Illusion at AK Press. Hopeless is also available in a Kindle edition. Mike can be reached at FergieWhitney@MSN.com. That's F-E-R-G-I-E Whitney@MSN.com. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Mike Whitney, our soapbox friend. Mike Whitney, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me, Cindy.
Oh, it's always great to have you on. And I know when I asked you, I'm going to embarrass you a little bit. You said that you didn't really like to give interviews because you're not very good at it. But you've been on the soapbox, and I think that you're very informative. And I wouldn't keep asking you back if I didn't think that you were a good interview.
Well, thanks very much.
Okay.
You know, the idea that people can transition easily from writing and doing research to doing interviews and collecting their thoughts is a bit of an assumption. I've been asked a number of times from, like Press TV and RT and stuff like that, and the idea of transitioning to TV is even more daunting. So I'm sure you've been on there, but, I'd rather stay behind my computer and do my work there.
Well, and that's okay. And, we're friends, and so this is always just like a chat, like two friends having a chat about current events and world emergencies. So the reason I asked you back on is because I wanted to give my listeners an update about what's happening in the Ukraine and East Ukraine, Crimea, and because we have been following this story. Now, CNN and what I call CIANN and MSNBCIA and Faux News and all those people would like to have us think that Putin is aggressive and the United States is just protecting the people of the Ukraine. So can you give my listeners an update about the truth and what's happening there?
Sure. But first of all, I want to, explain that I don't consider myself an expert. I am reading a lot of alternative media and trying to get as up to speed as anyone else. But, I am not an expert by any means. That said, there is good news and bad news on the Ukraine front, which, by the way, is grabbing everyone's attention. I've never gotten so many emails on articles that I'm getting right now. It's amazing. You know, people in Berlin and people in, Russia, et cetera, have been writing. Anyway, what is happening right now that is on the good side of things is that Putin is, as we speak, attending a meeting of the OSCE, which is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And he just announced a plan for establishing some kind of peace. And what he wants is a direct dialogue from representatives of people in the eastern Ukraine who have been called separatists, but more accurately just want more autonomy for their region so that they're not persecuted by the pro-European coup government as they have been in recent days. So, this is amazingly constructive offer that Putin is making, mainly from the point of view that after the terrible Odessa fire,
right,
where 46 people were massacred in a fire that was caused by far-right extremist neo-Nazis in Odessa just a few days ago, people expected that they would have crossed Putin's red line and he would have sent in the tanks to provide protection for ethnic Russians in the area. Instead, he showed enormous restraint, he actually offered to withdraw his troops from the border, which is one of the demands the United States was making. So he, you know, he gave in, he gained ground in that regard. And he also asked the people in the East to suspend a referendum, which was going to provoke hostility from the coup government. And the referendum would have allowed for greater autonomy. These people just wanted to know that whatever direction Ukraine goes politically, that they're not going to, the persecution that has been witnessed in recent weeks by the crackdowns in the East is not going to continue. So here's Putin saying basically, give peace a chance. Mm-hmm. And now, so the United States and their European ally partners, we have a chance to see whether there's any interest on Washington's part to move in a direction that might end the hostilities.
Do you see parallels to the run up in the war in Iraq when, you know, Saddam Hussein was trying to do similar kinds of things, saying, well, come on, bring the inspectors in. I even had a friend who met with Tariq Ali. Is that his name? He was the mm-hmm. minister. And he told them, we've offered to give you the oil if you just don't invade us. Do you see parallels like that? It didn't seem like there was anything. It seemed like Hussein was being the reasonable actor in the run-up to the invasion. Do you see some similarities?
Absolutely. You know, Putin has done everything he can to back away from this conflict. He doesn't want the conflict. He had to protect his deep water port, where in Crimea has been a part of the Russian, country for like 300 years.
Right.
So it's just been a recent development that it was part of the Ukraine territory. But yeah, some of the differences that are the glaring differences are that at least, Bush, when he threatened to invade Iraq, came up with mobile weapons labs and WMD and phantom aluminum tubes and all kinds of excuses. If you really think about what's happening now, apart from the phony pictures of Russian soldiers that the New York Times has retracted and said that they were phony, of Russian troops in Ukraine, Barack Obama is just saying, trust me. He's mm-hmm. saying, essentially, I don't have to produce any proof.
Right.
We're saying that Russia is pulling all the strings in Ukraine, and we have the right to levy these sanctions without any evidence. And this whole thing is spinning towards war. And the question is whether they will use, you know, on the president's authority, just saying, trust me, if that's going to be enough to, you know, to ratchet up the hostilities even more. So, but yes, Putin is doing everything in his power to reduce the tensions. And on our side, I think because the policy is such that we cannot make this pivot to Asia with Russia that is closely economically tied to Europe as it presently is. Europe or Russia is producing a tremendous amount of natural gas and oil for Europe. They're natural partners. And Europe needs the oil, so it's just a normal business relationship. Unfortunately, someone is left out of that relationship, and the person who's left out is the United States. So if they want to relocate in the most prosperous region in the next century, they have to take steps that make a separation between Europe and Russia. So I think that's why what should be really alarming to everyone about this situation is that if the policy goes forward, the policy, is something that whether Putin wants to make great concessions for peace or not, if the policy doesn't allow for that because, you know, the people in Washington see our future as wrapped up with, you know, invading and establishing NATO bases, et cetera, and surrounding the Russian Federation and controlling mm-hmm. China's growth, mm-hmm. then, we're headed for war.
You said controlling China's growth, which is very significant. I think my opinion is that this is all part of the Asian Pacific pivot, they're calling it, in foreign policy, away from the Middle East and, you know, to Africa, China, Russia, those places that, well, especially Africa and Eastern Europe, where the U.S. thinks that it has interests, and China is becoming more of a global power, significantly through mostly economic diplomacy, not you know, threats of war and military aggression.
Well, you probably followed Obama's last dismal trip to the Far East, where he went to basically Tokyo and South Korea and the Philippines, basically just unintentionally bypassing Beijing. And basically every place he went, he was doing things that would have been considered tweaking China's nose.
Mm-hmm.
So he is trying to get the allies on board with this kind of policy that is basically sending a message to China. And that's why the United States is upping its warships in the South China Sea area and trying to work out a deal for military bases in the Philippines, because over 80% of China's oil is carried on freighters. So,
mm-hmm.
So if the United States can control the seas, then they control the oil, which means that they can control China's growth. Now, China is very concerned about that, which is why they want pipelines from Iran and stuff like that. But you can see the problems they're facing, and the message the United States is passing along in very clear terms is, you know, we're going to be the boss, you know, in the future, so just get used to it. But where does that leave Russia?
Right.
I mean, Russia understands what the policy is, and that's why, you know, Putin very wisely avoided sending troops into Ukraine, because the whole thing is intended just to lure him in so that he's bogged down as he was in, as the Russians were in Afghanistan, and he has another mini Vietnam on his hands. Well, that's the last thing he needs. And meanwhile, you know, he will be demonized in the press as being an aggressor,
right.
And that will, you know, that will forestall any opportunity he has to deepen his relationships economically with Europe. The United States basically doesn't care if the people in Europe pay twice as much for their natural gas next year to heat their homes or to run their machinery, as long as, you know, their policy objectives are established. So that's how I see it.
It's really disgusting. I've been to Scandinavia several times. I've been to, you know, Norway, Sweden, and oh, what's the other country? And they are so, like, righteously angry with the United States. And this was long before this stuff started happening in the Ukraine, because they just tell me, we can't vote for your president, but your president screws us up so much. It's just amazing. And people always say, oh, other countries don't hate the U.S. They hate the government, but, you know, that's not really true. They see us as keeping on voting for these people who are profoundly harming their lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, there's a natural business relationship that should be strengthened in the world we live in today with an energy producer and people who need a lot of energy, especially a wealthy area like Europe. So we have to disrupt that and create a public relations excuse for doing that. So that's why they pulled that old canard out of their bag that, you know, Putin is evil, Putin is Hitler, everything wrong with the world comes from Putin.
Right.
You know, it's just ridiculous. And all of the media are covering that. And that explains why guys like John Kerry and even Obama said the other day, well, this nonstop drumbeat of propaganda, this propaganda bullhorn, they own every major media in the United States and Europe. I mean, you just went through the long litany of propagandists in the United States whose stories never veer much from the person the other person. And And so they're complaining about a few voices like Russia Today and Ikar Tass and stuff like that. I mean, this is when you realize the ridiculousness of their position.
We see it over and over again. We see demonization, Fidel Castro. We see Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Bashar al-Assad, my friend Hugo Chavez. We see this constant demonization, and now it's Putin, like you said. He's the new evil dictator, Hitler. And it's just like people here in the United States are just so, a lot of them, I don't say everybody, because people listening to this show certainly are, they're just so pathetic. It seems like they eat it up like it's ice cream or something.
Well, you know, you make a really good point, and I'm really glad that you mentioned Cuba, because I think that illustrates a very important point that you probably take to heart regarding Chavez and the Venezuela situation, which is, once in the bad graces of Washington, you cannot escape that. It's just like, it's been 60 years of this embargo. Everyone else has given up on it. Doesn't matter.
Right.
The people who are behind the politicians in Washington, I mean the big money guys, the guys who own everything, these guys have long memories, and these guys have such an outrageous sense of entitlement. The world is ours. If you cross us, you're done. It doesn't matter if it's today. I mean, after the first coup in Venezuela, people were convinced that's the end of it. The United States failed. They're going to throw in the towel now.
Mm-hmm.
Never happened.
Mm-mm.
They're never going to give up.
Never.
You know, we're the people who need regime change.
Exactly.
Them.
Not regime, systemic change is what we need. Because we'll get a
Absolutely.
New regime. We'll get a new regime in 2016, and it'll be a peaceful, so-called democratic transfer of power, but it'll be just the same people in power.
Oh, my God. Is that the I mean, think of it right now. A coin toss between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. Isn't that what we're looking at? I mean, this is really the most...
I think between now and...
It doesn't get any worse, does it?
It doesn't. Between now and 2016, I'll lose a lot of weight, because that literally makes me sick to my stomach to think of something like that. So,
you know, here's my own little conspiracy theory, okay?
Uh-huh.
Which is that all of the attacks on Chris Christie have actually been behind-the-scenes arm-twisting from the Jeb Bush clan, because they saw him as the only viable competitor to Jeb Bush. So I think they set out to torpedo his campaign early on and just make him look like a big bozo, which they have successfully done.
Oh, absolutely. That's, you know, it's probably more like a fact than a conspiracy theory. Mike, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time again. And trust me, you were great. I'm an authority on that. But you do publish at Counterpunch. And is that the best place?
That is the best place. Other sites pick it up now.
Uh-huh.
I actually have an article probably coming out tomorrow that I think will interest some people about the Odessa fire. Which was actually a false flag operation, and so I think from other sources people might find it kind of interesting in that regard.
Well, make sure to send me the link, and I'll post it on our newsletter for this weekend. So
I sure will, and thanks a lot for having me, Cindy.
Okay, Mike Whitney, thank you so much again for giving us your time on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. You know, you're not an expert, but I know you say you're not an expert, but I know you do a lot of research, and so we really appreciate you sharing that with us. And you know, it's important to get it out in a lot of different formats, I think.
Always a pleasure, Cindy. Thank you.
Okay, Mike. Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye.
Our next guests are from the organization called A Wrong Kind of Green. And we have Gregory Vickery. He's my friend and a consultant in the nonprofit and political arenas and a collaborator with The Wrong Kind of Green. He may be reached at Gregory@gregoryvickery.com. That's Gregory VICKREY.com. And joining Gregory and I is Corey Morningstar. Corey is an independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist, focusing on global ecological collapse and political analysis of the nonprofit industrial complex. She resides in Canada. Her recent writings can be found on Wrong Kind of Green, The Art of Annihilation, Political Context, Counterpunch, Canadians for Action on Climate Change, and Countercurrents. Her writing has also been published by Bolivia Rising and Cambio, the official newspaper of the plurinational state of Bolivia. Okay, Gregory Vickery and Corey Morningstar, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you very much. Gregory.
Okay, well, listeners, you're in for quite a treat because it seems like Gregory, Corey, and I have been drinking mimosas all morning, but we haven't really been doing that. We've just been having a giggly time. But I just want to say the issues we're going to talk about are extremely, extremely important and frightening and everything that's happening. But like we say on the soapbox, you have to keep a sense of humor because we're still alive and what are we going to do?
Corey's probably more apt at that simply because she's the founder and sort of savior and goddess of everything that is the Wrong Kind of Green. I've been very, very lucky over the years, last few years, to sort of ride her coattails. And but I mean the general premise and certainly Corey jump in here, the general premise is to describe the money trail associated with the nonprofit environmental complex and talk about the realities of what we face when we think we're doing good and we're really not. When we think we're awesome because we donate $25 to NRDC or the Sierra Club, and we find out that what we're really doing is an inclusion with oil companies and fracking companies and that sort of thing. So the Wrong Kind of Green has had a long history, thanks to Corey, to exposing that through very diligent investigative work. And I've been very lucky to sort of ride on the coattails of Corey's expertise in helping view that from a scientific perspective and a very verbose, opinionated perspective, if you will. And I think Corey would probably echo that sentiment.
Well,
thank you, Gregory.
Let me then go into this kind of weird thing. Most of my, I don't know about my listeners. My listeners are pretty smart. They're pretty savvy about these kinds of issues. And the whole 350.org, Bill McKibben, I think some of my listeners would still think that he was some kind of radical left-wing environmentalist. But talk about the pipeline protest and what was really like behind that. And, you know, the people were getting arrested, but it wasn't as radical an action as most people would have had invested in it.
You go ahead, Gregory, if you like.
No, I think you should take this first, and I'll jump in.
Well, basically, the whole Keystone XL campaign cropped up, I believe, back in 2010. I've written a series, investigative series on the subject. Basically, all of a sudden, you started hearing about the Keystone XL, so now we've got a whole entire, quote-unquote, environmental movement focused on one singular pipeline. Meanwhile, while that happened, year after year, Warren Buffett, who's a financial advisor to your President Obama, or Colonel Obama, mm-hmm. he basically started to create a massive rail. I mean, he started reviving the whole idea of North American rail, the empire, right? Sorry, go ahead, Cindy.
No, no, go ahead. It was my phone.
Okay. Okay, so basically, while everyone's, you know, chanting Stop the Keystone Itself, Stop the Keystone Itself, in the background, we have a huge rail empire being built that no one's watching. And then we have oil via rail going across tracks all across North America, building, building, building. I mean, it's a massive, booming industry now. Since last year, we've had 10 derailments of rail carrying crude that have resulted in almost 50 deaths. I mean, in Montreal, we had people vaporized. And, you know, now the groups, now that sort of people know that this huge rail industry has sprung up, you know, all while this symbolic campaign was taking place, now they're sort of pretending that they've been talking about it all along, you know, when they haven't. And so not only was it, you know, a waste of time to protest a single pipeline, because, I mean, two different sections are already operating,
right.
They're in operation. But now we've watched production and oil production, fracking, everything else just continue to expand and boom, right? And so it's the whole point. When that campaign started, it was stop tar sands. You know, years and years ago by Indigenous peoples, it started stop the tar sands, and then it was co-opted and changed to stop the Keystone Itself. So you take your eye off of, you know, basically stopping at the source, and then instead you have the populace focus on this one specific thing. And meanwhile, you know, the system just continues to expand and grow, and our missions just begin, you know, continue to soar. So it's been a huge distraction and a huge waste of time and a great investment for Buffett, who, through his son's foundation that he set up with his money, Noble Foundation, is the number one funder of Tides, who basically hands out the money to all the NGOs for the tar sands campaign. So Wrong Kind of Green, back to what we're talking about, basically educates people and demonstrates how we continue over and over and over to be reabsorbed back into the system.
Hello?
Well, I think... I think how Corey explains it is exactly right, and I sort of call it the Sierra Club syndrome. Everyone knows who the Sierra Club is, and we go on Sierra Club sponsored hikes, and we think we're doing good for the environment because we donate our $25 or $30 a year or whatever it is to the Sierra Club. But the trouble is they're getting $20 million or $40 million, depending on the year, from the oil industry or the fracking industry and things of those nature, and there's no individual ability to counteract that. I'm sorry, but going on a Sierra Club sponsored hike does not counteract their overall support for maintaining the status quo of a particular industry. It just doesn't happen. It can't happen. So at Long Con Green, we do everything we can to expose that. From an investigative perspective, but also from a scientific perspective. And I think that's where the symbiosis between Corey and I sort of mesh. I mean, she's an incredible investigator, and I'm sort of the geeky science nerd. And when we put those two things together, all of a sudden it tells a very impactful story about the reality of things. We're no longer talking about fantasy. We're unabashed about talking about things that... are pretty and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we try to describe reality for what it is. And, you know, our ultimate goal is to get, you know, all of the people that are willing to pay attention to us, our ultimate goal is to say, okay, well, here are the steps that we can take, not only as individuals, but collectively as a reorganized, paradigm-shifted community to a new vision. And that means challenging the status quo. Because if you have an organization like the Sierra Club or NRDC or most recidivists, in my language, the Nature Conservancy, if you support those kinds of organizations, you're supporting the status quo. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
that is the quintessential definition of the environmental industrial complex. And if you're willing and able to challenge those paradigms, then you've got to think outside of the boundaries of what's acceptable today, what might be acceptable tomorrow, and certainly what was acceptable yesterday, and redefine where your money and your time and your energy goes. And that's ultimately what Rome kind of Green's energy is directed towards.
I am, of course, I'm running for governor of California. We have a very comprehensive environmental platform. We think that is, you know, this is the most urgent issue that we should face and correct as a people, grassroots or governmental or however we can do it. But since I've been running for governor, I've gone to 3 events that were sponsored by or co-sponsored by 350.org. And as soon as I got to these events, I was spotted and I don't want to say surrounded, but kind of made very aware that, you know, I was free to stay. That's so nice of them. But I would not be allowed to speak or have any kind of prominence because they are a 501c3 and they didn't want to harm any, you know, of their nonprofit status. However, you know, this really like gets me because these organizations, they claim to want, to stop global warming or, you know, further degradation of the environment, but they will stay connected to the status quo. And I think a lot of times for these organizations, it's about protecting their funding and protecting their access to the polluters.
Well, I'll jump in here very quickly, and Corey, I know you can add this from a Canadian perspective, but certainly in the United States, people need to understand a very basic analogy. Jerry Brown equals 350.org. Barack Obama equals, for those of you in California, Barack Obama equals 350.org. Regardless of the 501c3 nonprofit status, they advocate for the kinds of approaches that those individuals and their administrations choose to pursue. And in California, we know, Cindy, you and I both know the level of destruction that California has faced because of environmental policies enacted by the Brown administration.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly nationally, when Obama, shortly after he's inaugurated in 2009, gives $2 billion to the facade of clean coal to his home state of Illinois, we know that there's a game being played here. It's a political game and it's a monetary game. It's all about the economics as opposed to the realism of environmental conditions. And when we're willing as individuals to face up to that, we have very few places to go. We look around and say, okay, well, I can donate some time to the Sierra Club, or maybe I can donate some money to the Nature Conservancy and these kinds of things. And we think that that's a proactive approach, but the reality is, the scientific, actual reality is, that's not true. We're not changing anything by giving the Sierra Club $25 and becoming a member and getting a cool grocery bag
mm-hmm.
that we can shop with. We're not changing paradigms. We have to start thinking outside of the parameters of the current status quo. And as time moves forward, the paradigm within which we can change narrows. Not only for our species, but for all species. We're really screwing up the planet. And if we all acknowledge that, and if we all say, okay, I believe in climate change and those sorts of things, and we acknowledge that, moving forward, we know the paradigm within which we can change narrows as the future approaches. So the choices we make brush up against the law. They brush up against what the environmental groups are telling us. They brush brush up against what the industrialists who fund the environmental groups are telling us. So all of a sudden we find ourselves in conflict with the status quo. What can we do, you know, as individuals on a daily basis to challenge, to make change, those sorts of things. So, Long County Green, our effort has not only has our effort been generated towards educating people, but you know, now our philosophy is, and Corey, you know, certainly jump in here. Our philosophy is to start defining things that, yeah, there are things we can do at an individual level, recognizing that they're insignificant as an individual level. Nonetheless, we can use them as teaching tools and mechanisms for salvaging the future. It's no longer about it's no longer about salvaging the status quo. It's about salvaging some part of the future such that we can exist, our kids can exist, our grandchildren can exist. We have to think selfishly in those terms, but we have to fit that within the paradigm of all species because, you know, everyone, you know, in fourth grade is educated about the food chain and all that sort of stuff. We have to analyze and understand that, you know, if things below us collapse, we're going to collapse from a selfish standpoint. So what do we do to maintain some semblance of balance? Well, we're past. People need to understand this. We are past the point of no return with regards to balance.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it is. There's going to be a collapse, and we have to figure out a mechanism within which to. I don't want to say survive because that's an overly selfish term, but within the paradigm of collapse, which is imminent scientifically, mm-hmm. we have to say. Okay, well, how can we persevere? I think that's a much better word. So if we're going to define the parameters within which we can persevere, then you have to say all of a sudden, you know what, screw city codes. I'm going to grow a garden in my front yard. Mm-hmm. I'm going to redefine the term community. And no longer is my community going to be established by the parameters of the suburb within which I live. And all of a sudden, we're going to share food because we're all growing food in our front yards. We're all going to rewild our backyards. Those kinds of things, while they seem simple and almost symbolic, they redefine parameters. And at the same time, we have to be willing and able to agitate. And groups like 350.org and others, they faux agitate. They put themselves out there as part of a marketing campaign as opposed to establishing definitive parameters about what is changed and what is not. And Ron Connick Green does a very good job of exposing that.
Well, and it's like Corey said, groups like 350.org perform a service to the 1%, if that's what we want to call them, as being distractions, to divert people, really, you know, basically good people who really care about these issues, to divert them into, you know, these distractions so that doesn't harm chances for Democrats to get elected.
Yeah, like, I mean, the Rockefellers, the Ford Foundation, everybody else, they don't pump billions of dollars into the nonprofit industrial complex for nothing.
Right.
They pump it in there because it's tax-free money and it's the best investment they've ever made. You know, that whole complex is put in place to protect a system that must be dismantled, you know? And so it's really, really frustrating that people even for some reason would believe for a second that the same people that oppress us and enslave us are going to, you know, fund our freedom.
Our salvation. You know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And, you know, take Abbas, for example. They, one of the founders is Tom Curiello, you know, a Democrat who did get in the last election in the States. You know, he's very, very pro-war. And then you could see the role that Avaz played in the annihilation, destruction of Libya and her people,
mm-hmm.
and again, they tried the same thing in Syria.
Right.
It's a dangerous organization with, you know, that war ideology. And another founder of Avaaz, aside from Tom Perriello, or however you pronounce his name, is MUVON, right? MUVON.org, which was openly a front party for the Democrats. So again, it's about all being sucked back into the system that we claim we're opposing, and a system that must be dismantled for the survival of all species on the planet. And we just keep getting reabsorbed. Rick and Patel of Avaaz, one of the founders, makes almost $200K a year from Avaaz, and people are shelling out their last $20. I mean, it's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not including his consulting for the UN, the Gates Foundation, wherever else he can, you know, whoever else he consults for. It's crazy. 350.org presents themselves as a scruffy little grassroots outfit, and they have this international advisory board. You know, their staff, a lot of them make around $100K a year, over $100K a year. I mean, it's a joke. You know, they're not grassroots, and what they do, where they instill a lot of damage is in the true grassroots communities, and especially the people on the front lines, which are usually indigenous communities.
Right.
You know, and they fly in at the last second for the photo op, and basically undermine all the work and then go back, you know, to getting more grant money.
Well, you're up there in Canada, as I call you, you know, and there's quite a wonderful grassroots militant anti tar sands pipeline, whatever, you know, movement up there. But you also write about South America and Pachamama. Corey, can you tell my listeners about that?
Again, it's the same type of thing. If you look closely, everything's connected like one great big massive spider web, and it does take time, you know, to see how these webs connect and how they're woven into each other. And that's the frustrating part, because people don't really want to do the work. We've all been programmed to, you know, want to know everything in 5-second sound bites.
Right.
And that's, you know, thanks to mainstream media and education and everything else. You have to be disciplined if you want to learn, and you have to take the time to read and educate yourself and you know, ask these questions prior. But basically, same type of thing. Pachamama Foundation, which was just shut down in Ecuador, is, let's see, it's set up by Pachamama Alliance out of San Francisco, California.
Yep.
And again, you know, funded, you can go back and look at all their funding. I mean, these are what we've got. We've got an American established NGO set up in Ecuador and tied into Western interests. You know, a lot of the funders are, for example, Crow Red, right, which is basically a market mechanism to basically make forests to commodify nature, basically make forests into commodities. So that's just one aspect of it. You've got all these people. Essentially, you've got U.S. tied to imperial interests, tied to Western interests, sitting in Ecuador. And I mean, this happens all over the world, and these NGOs are used like the CIA. I mean, how Easter exists, to destabilize these governments. They go into countries, they find divisions where there's no divisions, they create divisions, and they use them to create destabilizations, to overthrow governments. And so it's really, really, really important not to jump on these, you know, on these bandwagons when the NGOs start crying foul. I mean, you have to check who they really are. And the majority of the time, like I said, they're all tied to American interests.
Right.
And so we're playing with people's lives here, you know, like Libya, up to 100,000 people dead, who knows, maybe more. You know, it's just people don't understand the severity of the consequences.
And I really like what you said, because I get all these emails to sign a petition for a vase or whatever, and it just, you try to, if it's somebody you know, you try to, like, educate them a little bit about it. But then, of course, you get accused of being a purist or something like that, and that's not even the issue.
Well, here's the thing, Cindy. I mean, what purism means to me is what is the situation on the ground, and what can I do about it? There's no better definition of purism to me than that. So if we look at the politics of Ukraine, for example, incredibly prominent right now, and not at all disassociated with environment and environmental conditions. Why is the Ukraine all of a sudden so important to U.S. interests? Well, it happens to be natural gas. It happens to be pipelines. It happens to be a few rare access to a few rare minerals that allow us to build our fancy wind plants and solar plantations on public lands in the United States and that sort of thing. We sort of galvanize our reputation as do-gooders internationally as a country in order to set up the framework for what we need in the next 10 to 20 years. So thinking about that approach and trying to look through that scope as an environmentalist, as somebody who understands the science of reality and that sort of thing, we say, okay, so where are the hotspots in the world? Well, you know, it happens to be in and around Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan and all those places, but also Africa, too. Africa is the greatest playground for the United States, and most people don't realize this. Corey talked about Libya, and you can put that within the context of the Arab Spring and those sorts of things, but there was one legitimate revolution in the Arab Spring, and that was the first one. That was in Tunisia.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest were mechanized by America, the United States, taking advantage of the unrest, such that we could redefine our advantage in the region. And the reason why is because, politically speaking, all of a sudden we found ourselves at a disadvantage with the Chinese. The Chinese were saying, well, we have gobs of money. What we're going to do is we're going to spend gobs of money to buy up large parcels of land, not only for what the land could provide itself, i.e. food, but for what may potentially be under the land, what minerals, what resources, that sort of thing.
Right.
So Africa has become the great American playground, and it's the new Cold War between the United States and China,
right,
and to a limited extent Russia, but predominantly between the United States and Russia. I'm sorry, the United States and China, as to in terms of defining what happens next in the expansion of the empire, if you will. So you see the United States all of a sudden active in more than, they won't acknowledge this, but in more than 35 countries in Africa. Well, why is that? And it's because we see a paradigm shift, politically speaking, with regards to energy resources and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, sort of on the periphery, you have organizations like 350.org and the Nature Conservancy and et cetera, saying, well, we need to expand solar. Well, we need to expand wind. And you think about the number and the types of resources that need to be expanded in order to embellish wind expansion, in order to embellish solar expansion, and the rare minerals that are required to do so, and where they are located on the planet. And you see the United States chasing those resources, as well as China. That is the new Cold War. That is, that's the great fallacy that we all sort of believe in as progressives, if you will. You know, a progressive in California, a progressive in Tennessee, doesn't matter where you are, you think, oh, you know, we need to build more wind. We need to produce more solar. Well, that sounds really neat on paper. But when you analyze what it takes to produce that energy, you know, from the very base, just like gasoline. I mean, speaking as an American, if Americans were paying the real price of gasoline, we'd be paying close to $18 a gallon.
Right, like
gasoline.
They do in Europe.
Yeah.
It's like $9 a liter in Europe.
Can you imagine what it is to produce solar and wind and all these so-called energetic sources. And years ago, I guess, NRDC especially, in 2008, 2007, they promoted natural gas as sort of a transition fuel to these new energy sources. If you can imagine what it takes to produce those things, you know, on a global level, to the point where Americans can be satiated at their current lifestyle, and Europeans can be satiated at their current lifestyle. You think about that, and the economic divide becomes even broader than it currently is. And it's hard to imagine. I think it's especially hard to imagine to the listeners of your program. How can the economic divide become even more dramatic than it really is? Well, if we were a solar economy, if we were a wind economy, the economic divide would be even broader. And people don't get that. People are unwilling to analyze things from that perspective.
What would be your solution to provide energy, our energy needs then?
There is no solution, Cindy.
We don't have
energy needs. We have energy wants.
Right.
And I know Corey can talk about this far more better than me. But.
I mean, I walk and ride my bike.
Sorry, I was just going to say that basically, I agree with Gregory, where this is the final scramble for what remains of the Earth's natural resources. That's mm-hmm. where we're at right now. This is it. It's the mad dash is on, right? And
yep.
NGOs are an instrumental key. They're an extension of the state. They're not independent of the state. They are an extension. They're an extension to further, you know, foreign interests, foreign policies, you know, protect the empire, protect the system. And yeah, I mean, a really good book, what Gregory's talking about, you know, the NGOs want us to believe that all we have to do is simply switch from, you know, fossil fuels to green energy. It's bullshit. It's a lie. It's not true. Because we're not addressing anything else, right? We're not addressing consumption. No one's saying we can't live like this any longer.
How do you guys feel about eco-socialism?
Five years ago, my answer would have been entirely different than what I'm about to say. I believe I'm a scientist, so I believe in J1's paradox. I believe that, you know, if you cut a little bit back here, you want a lot more elsewhere. So, you know, in the United States, we could implement all sorts of energy efficient systems, which we have.
Right.
We have, frankly. Since prior to the Bush administration, you know, since the Clinton administration, we've implemented all sorts of amazing, technologies that allow us to be more energy efficient. And some semblances, you know, as the Obama administration, contends, with regards to emissions in vehicles and gasoline efficiencies and that sort of thing. But it's a fallacy. You know, Obama can give us a car that gives us 50 miles per gallon, or 50 miles per gallon. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds really neat on paper.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, if I can drive 50 miles per gallon on paper, I'm going to drive 60 tomorrow. I mean, that's Javon's paradox.
Uh-huh.
When the efficiency is defined, we're going to take advantage of it.
Right.
I just wanted to jump in and say I just came across a report about a month ago that states just that. I mean, we are producing more renewables than we ever have, and guess what? We're using up more energy than we ever have. We're producing more emissions than we ever have.
And that's why Jay Volmos is so smart. I mean, that's why he defined it as a paradox. We realize savings here, so we spend money elsewhere. It's the Walmart. It's Sam Walton in action.
Uh-huh.
And we're talking about Walmart on a global scale with regards to everything we do.
Have either of you read the book on Ozzy, what's his name, Zehmer? Z-E-H-M-E-R, Green Illusions? And, you know, basically it says, wind is renewable, turbines are not.
Is that the book you were going to mention? Because I kind of cut you off. You were talking about a book, and then I asked a question.
I don't know.
Sorry about that.
I have so many
books. We're running out of time. Unfortunately, it's been a great conversation. But, like you were saying, Gregory, I had some campaign events over the weekend. And there's no way to get around where I live, from city to city. When I'm home, it's fine. It's my bike. It's my car. Not my car. It's my bike. It's my feet, because I don't have a car. My bike, my feet, the bus, maybe, but the buses are really inefficient and they take forever. I can literally walk anywhere in Vacaville faster than the bus can get me there. But so I had to rent a car. So I rented a very fuel-efficient car. And I prepaid for gas because it's like 60 cents cheaper to prepay than it would. But then I had like 72 miles, and I thought, I feel like just driving 72 miles to use this gas up that I prepaid for. So that's almost exactly what you were just talking about.
Sure.
And I didn't. I dropped the car off and then walked home. But, So what is this? What can we do? Independent of the government, independent of the NGOs, the environmental industrial complex.
Well, I know that Cory Wilkes chiming here too. Just being friends and colleagues with her for so long, but I will say that. There's a very delicate balance as individuals that we have to be willing to face. There's great despair, and we have to acknowledge that scientifically, because that is reality. And there is the hope that we can attach ourselves to, that things will be okay or things will be better. I call myself, and you know this, Cindy, I've called myself an optimistic fatalist for years.
Uh-huh.
We have to embrace that modality. We have to understand that the scope of what we can do as an individual is very limited. But we have to promote what can be done on a grand scale. We have to be willing and gutsy enough to talk about it on a large scale. So, I think it's great. You know, when I came to visit you last, I rode the bus, and there were 50 people on the bus, and I thought that was incredibly environmentally economical and all those sorts of things. But do I need to visit you?
Right.
I need to ask that question.
Right.
I mean, do I need fruit grown in your yard? You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're really getting down, and people will not understand this when I say it. Maybe they'll understand it 20 years from now. It's a very common phrase. It's very cliche. We need to get down to brass tacks.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be able to say, screw the city codes. I'm growing whatever I want to in my front yard. And not only am I going to feed my family from that, but I'm going to feed my neighbors family from that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to do the same thing. And I'm going to take some space in my backyard to rewild things so that the bees that want to sting me can sting me.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's very simplistic. But we have to understand that the planet is demanding us to be simplistic. There are no technological fixes to this. I've seen all the Zeitgeist movies. I appreciate them. I like the knowledge that they purport, for example. The planet is much smarter than the current level of technology that we can provide. It's the way it is. We can't spew a bunch of stuff up in the clouds in order to curtail emissions. We can't.
Right. Corey?
There's no controlling the climate. So,
yeah, I agree with everything Gregory's saying. I mean, exactly. Grow your own food. Do what you can. And we do that not because we think that's going to change the world or change things or stop climate change, because nothing but virtual zero emissions can do that, which, you know, we're not going to get to. And I mean, let's not even get into the inertia that's sitting in the system right now. That won't show up for decades. But I mean, we do that because we should. We do that to be responsible citizens, to be, you know, good educators, to be good parents to our children, to teach our children, and to have some dignity. And so I think at this, you know, juncture, what we need to do is really reevaluate our priorities and really scale back. It's true that we're all trapped within a suicidal system.
Right.
We're all trapped in a system that's killing us, but that doesn't mean we have to, you know, keep supporting it. We can grab back, and we can, you know, starve the system where we're able to, you know, and we can find pockets where we can resist the system and get out of the system. And you know, I think that's so important. So, again, even if we can't change the whole thing, even if it's too late, it doesn't even matter, because, you know, let's, as a species, let's try to find some dignity, some ethics, you know, and treat each other with decency. Yeah, and so, again, like, these things are tangible things. You know, toss out your TV and get to work.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of work to be done. Like, let's not just leave our kids completely. Let's try to build something better, even in the midst of this disaster. And even while we're trapped in the system, let's try to keep finding ways, you know, like, to sort of knock it down one block at a time.
So, thank you so much, Corey Morningstar and Gregory Vickery, for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. But is there a website, Corey? I know you write and you're published all over. Do you have a best website that people can get more information?
For the nonprofit industrial complex, www. Gregory, is it Wrong Kind of Green? WrongKindOfGreen.org.
Yes.
And then mine's The Art of Annihilation.
I'm sorry, what was the second one?
The Art of Annihilation.
Great, Corey. Thank you. And Gregory?
Sounds good. Like I said, I'm hanging on Corey's coattails these days. So, LockingGreen.org is the one to roll to. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. And please,
thank you, Cindy.
Corey, send me like relevant links and stuff that I can put on the newsletter for this weekend. And you guys have a great day. And, you know, we'll just keep on doing what we can.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. That's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for today. I really can't say. I hope you enjoyed it. It was very informative, but it was also very sobering. A few years back, I was doing something called Recreating Revolutionary Communities, and I think it's about time that we got back to that, with a heavy emphasis on communities. And the revolutionary part is just basically being in community and working with each other to solve these issues. As always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer, Dee Dee Miller, my production assistant, my sometime helper, Mikey. I'd like to thank Mike Whitney, Gregory Vickery, and Corey Morningstar for joining us on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox this week. And as always, I'd like to thank you mostly for listening and supporting the show. And speaking of supporting the show, go to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and donate. We really need the funds, folks. And if you like the show and if you listen to it and if you learn something, give us a few dollars or pass it along so other people can hear it too. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.